Hello everyone, Joshua Gilliland here, one of the co-founders of the Legal Geeks. With me tonight is Captain Thomas Harper, now Army Reserves, to talk about the series finale of Star Wars Rebels. Thomas, how you doing?
Well, Grand Admiral Thrawn has recalled me to active duty for this very special mission, so I'm excited to join you.
They made Thrawn so much fun in this series. He will be missed.
They did. He's not gone. He's just faded into a distant memory now until his new book comes out.
Well, that, and they do put him on the same trajectory as the EU non-canon. So who knows? We might see him again. Maybe there's some connection with him and the creation of the First Order.
Right. And I appreciate, just not to have us dive in yet, but I appreciate, I could just picture now in my head the writers, like, what are we going to do with Thrawn? Let's just blast him off into the ether. We can do that, right? Just send him into hyperspace, like with no destination. Sure.
Let's make it so. Yeah. Well, with that, there have been lots of Star Wars podcasts that have talked about the wonderful series finale and what happened. And we're going to focus on the legal issues that we saw from the episode, and we'll of course fanboy and talk about, you know, what we loved about it, but a lot of people have already hit a lot of the, you know, the solid points about how great the series was and how fun the series finale was. So for the first legal issue from the finale, Governor Price is a POW, and Ezra uses one of the Lothal wolves to get her to comply and providing the victory code so they can fly back to the Imperial Dome. Now, would the use of that wolf be considered torture or an enhanced interrogation of some kind for her compliance?
I never thought that I would be coming to the defense of Arinda Price, but here I'm in her corner. For all her flaws and her evilness and her own war crimes that she committed, unfortunately, Ezra and the Rebels stepped a big line when they brought in these gigantic direwolf looking, you know, creatures to do their bidding. It reminded me of the scene in the Clone Wars. No wolves were involved, but they're interrogating a separatist prisoner, I think it was Nuke Gunray, and Ahsoka lights up her lightsabers and goes at the prisoner. I could be wrong on who she was interrogating, but she holds the lightsaber right up to the prisoner's neck to coerce the information. And whether it's a wolf that's doing the coercing or not, that sort of thing is not allowed. I mean, there's a whole class of protections that are offered under the Geneva Conventions to prisoners of war. Like, how did the wolves strike you, Josh?
I do think from the enhanced interrogation point of view, that did cross the line into torture. And I hate to say she deserved it because she was pretty evil. And I'm glad she got what she had coming. And to be fair, the wolf doesn't like chew on her, or like it's not like she gets mauled and, you know, is forced to comply that way. But we do see she has a serious yellow streak in addition to being super mean and evil. And she rolls over. You know, I do think it technically would qualify as torture, but the Imperials do write the book on torture with making anyone from Callus to Leia watch rebel bases get either bombarded or planets blown up. Imperials love to gloat. They do love to torture with, I'm going to make you watch. But the rebels here really do kind of cross that line with, no, we're going to make you do this.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those things where the rebel cell here, and understandably they're not, Ezra and the rest of them are not operating under the larger rebel flag, but they stray an awful lot closer to the tactics used by Saw Gerrera and his partisans than the rest of the rebellion. And you look at real life law, you're absolutely right about the enhanced interrogation techniques. I think I don't know that those, like the DOJ or DOD, contemplated the use of gigantic overgrown force wolves in interrogating potential terrorists, but I feel like that would be called enhanced, right? So I think you're right on there. But the Geneva Conventions collectively take the treatment of POWs really, really seriously. I think if you crack open and look at the protections offered just across the board, you'd be amazed at how well layered and defined these protections are. And you look to the third protection, you know, sort of the top, if you were to rank the top 10 protections offered to POWs under the third Geneva Convention, protection from violence, intimidation, insults, and public curiosity. Well, look at those first two things, violence and intimidation. Just because Ezra and the gang need the information doesn't mean that they can get it at all costs. And operating on the outside of the law like that certainly puts them at risk, even though, you know, they're not getting arrested by any Imperials at this point.
It's important to follow the norms of the law. There was a debate when we tried the Nazis, with the Nuremberg war crimes, because you had those who were like Senator Robert Taft, who didn't have a problem with like we were the good guys, and he didn't have a problem with the Nazis being taken behind the barn to be shot. Like he was okay with that, because war itself is inherently evil. Putting rules on top of it to ensure compliance, is supposed to help cleanse it, to make it palatable to fight it, which then can cause us to actually get into more wars. On the flip side, society, demands us that we don't act like animals, which is why we put these restraints in place so we don't have, war looking like an episode of 24 with I'll just start breaking fingers until they talk. It's like, that's
And
not
talking
us.
like this.
Yeah. I'm going to use this hot knife and burn you. It's like, or in this case, a wolf to maul you. Highly problematic. And it's, I mean, I get why. I'm like, they were vastly outnumbered. This is a super small cell that was taking on, an imperial fortress. And so they were trying to have to use asymmetrical warfare and unconventional means to achieve their goals in order to liberate the planet. And I don't know if their thought process was, we can feel bad about it later, versus we're going to keep living with this because we don't want to compromise our principles. And that's a tough one.
Yeah, and the other thing that comes to mind is the ramifications of this sort of action. I don't think anybody's kidding themselves that we're not going to see, you know, a court martial played out or a war crimes trial played out. And I don't think, quite honestly, that the Galactic Empire and all of its benevolence would give these rebels like the due process of an actual trial if they got caught. But it does beg the question of if the Imperials see this, or citizens of the galaxy, if this sort of treatment got out, they see a governor, you know, an Imperial military commander that has surrendered and then gets treated like this by the rebels. A, what does that do to Imperial soldiers' willingness to follow the rules? I mean, presumably rebels are going to get captured from time to time in the future. You're risking their lives. You're putting them in jeopardy by violating the rules like this. But also it risks the support of the populace at large. You know, if I'm Joe Schmo sitting in the cantina and I hear about, you know, I keep hearing about these rebel terrorists, and then I see an incident like this, I'm like, you know, I think the Imperials have are really onto something. Maybe these guys do suck. They're mean and they sic wolves on the people that they capture. So as much as I appreciate Ezra's ability and desire to get stuff done quickly and take down a seemingly overwhelming task, there were other ways to go about it. But, you know, none are as entertaining on the screen as watching a giant wolf growl and snarl at her.
Yeah, the Jedi mind trick would have been a better way to have achieved the goal,
That's a great point.
Yeah, it's like he can do it, so why not? Or the wolf was just in the corner, but having the wolf approach her, I mean, like, that was full on intimidation. It would be a war crime. Not okay. But I understand why. But there were other ways to do this, especially with the overarching theme of the episode, from self-sacrifice to there's always another way.
Yeah,
And
absolutely. And Ezra's learning all these lessons, but kindness towards those you hate or your enemies, I guess, wasn't on that list that Kanan was trying to teach him from beyond the grave.
then, they had gone through a lot, and they had seen a lot of, from the Tarkin towns that were on Lothal, and farmers getting arrested because they refused to sell their land. I mean, they had been pushed to a breaking point, so roughing
Sure.
up the governor probably seemed minor to them compared to what they had been through themselves. So I could see
No
how they
doubt.
justified it in their own minds.
No doubt. And you brought up a good the business about victor's justice is a really interesting concept where, hey, look, if we win this battle, who cares? The ends justify the means. But that can lead to some significant problems.
Yeah, there's you have to be careful how you do that. And because I do believe in the mindset of fight war to win. And there was an article that was either in Naval Proceedings or I don't remember which military publication, where the argument from some retired, I think it was retired, and they might have been Marine Corps colonels or some higher rank, of the benefits of killing the enemy until they surrender, and they're dead means victory. And some of it was harsh. Some of it was like, I don't agree with it. A couple parts I did agree with from a rules of engagement perspective, but highly problematic when you come from a society that views and believes in freedom and justice, that we just go in, oh, we'll just carpet bomb them until they're dead and then walk away. It's like, I mean, we didn't do that after World War II. Like, we rebuilt Japan and Germany, made them friends,
Right.
and places like that's always been the American doctrine of the best way to not have another war later is to make sure that there are power plants, running water, schools, and industry. So no one falls to whether it's communism or extremism or whatever form of terrorism that's recruiting, that if you have a full belly and a comfortable life, you're not going to join a radical organization.
Absolutely. That plays you, I don't think the Galactic Empire really gets that concept in how they conduct their military operations. This idea that whatever you blow up, you're inevitably going to pay to rebuild in some form or fashion. And you see that in our operations now. We're a lot more deliberate in some places with how we use force. Look at Afghanistan. That's a great example where how many billions of dollars have been spent rebuilding stuff that we have blown up in the country? Iraq is another classic example of it. So I don't know that that Emperor Palpatine is so concerned with rebuilding Lothal. I think he's sort of content to just let it smolder if it means snuffing out the rebels. But it's definitely a component of real life strategic planning and whatnot.
Yeah, well, it's the lesson of Versailles, that you can't let Europe burn and expect everything to be hunky-dory afterwards. It's like, no, that kind of ensured the Germans were angry and would want to have a war in 20 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it's what then Hoover did right before he was president in making sure Europe was fed,
Oh, yeah.
and what we did right again after World War II in making sure people were fed. There are places that we failed, Vietnam being a good example, that we didn't build up South Vietnam enough for them to be their own nation state. But yeah, those lessons that we can opine upon to Star Wars of
Yeah, well, the broader point sits in my mind that whether you're the Rebel Alliance or the U.S. Army, You don't get to pick and choose when you follow the rules, just because it's convenient to you at a particular time. Because one day you're the flag waving defenders of freedom in the galaxy, and the next day you're sending folks off to your pet boar gullet over in the basement. So it's a slippery slope.
And you don't want to cross it. Which brings us to one of the other slippery slopes that we're in this episode of. They take control of the dome. They're going to have it fly into space and turn on the self-destruct. What are your thoughts on that from a rules of engagement in just blowing up a military target full of enemy combatants?
The first thing that came to my mind was, outside of the rules, what about the average Imperial? They're not a civilian per se, but say you're just stuck in the dining facility or the mess hall. You're just slopping protein cubes onto plates, and all of a sudden you're like, "Hey, we're taking off!" And then the next second, boom. The scale of it was something that I guess the rebels are specialists in blowing up large personnel facilities of the Empire. But at a core level, you're talking about targeting, principles of targeting, and whether the dome itself and the personnel aboard were valid military targets. We don't, obviously, we haven't seen every nook and cranny of that facility, but I assume that they're all Imperial soldiers or officers of some type. That makes them targets by valid military targets by virtue of the fact that they put on that uniform and operate in that facility. The facility itself is a military facility, so it's just because it's on booster rockets or whatever. I would liken it to a forward operating base sitting in Iraq or Afghanistan. And quite honestly, it doesn't matter where you're not safe or immune from attack just because you're sitting inside the wire, so to speak, on that base. The moment you step foot on that on enemy turf and you're in a an armed conflict scenario of some type, under the law, it's how business goes. You're a valid target. So the rebels, unlike their business with the wolves, I think we're doing it right with the blowing up that dome.
Do you have any idea what the crew complement of the dome would have been?
I don't know yet, but I feel like that needs to be answered in a visual guide of some type because that's exactly the kind of factoid that I really enjoy.
Now, what's the crew complement of a Star Destroyer?
Oh gosh. Now you're really testing my
Because
Star Wars trivia chops.
I heard somebody say 30,000, which seems a lot. I mean, 3,000 would make sense. 30,000 seemed high, but because I'm curious about that because of what happens with the three Star Destroyers that Thrawn brings back to Lothal. First, about Thrawn's Star Destroyer, it's the only one that I've seen that had art on the bottom of the lower hull, which
The
is reminiscent.
Chimera.
Yeah, which is reminiscent of nose art on military planes or on stealth fighters. They put the nose art in the bomb bay. So when they open up the bomb bay, that's when you can see the art.
Right.
Because it's radar reflective, all that good stuff. But that was interesting to see that he actually had art on the Star Destroyer.
And if you look closely, his stormtroopers or the stormtroopers that are stationed aboard the Chimera wear a distinctive, the Chimera emblem on their pauldrons. So they look a little different than the rest of the stormtroopers. And they had, there was a question, I don't know if it was a Rebels recon type question, but somebody had asked, are these stormtroopers different? Are they special? And the explanation was, no, they're distinctive. It's a distinctive insignia to denote their service under Thrawn's command. So, when I was at, if you look at different army units across the nation at different installations, the 82nd Airborne has their own insignia. The 101st has the Screaming Eagle. That's what they liken that to. I thought that was pretty cool. Looks like a
And
star. Oh, go ahead.
like ships have that, with here's the logo for a ship, like the Enterprise or
Yep.
the Kitty Hawk or whatever. Same with squadrons. So there's, you know, like that's steeped in military tradition, to have that distinct logo to show what unit that they're serving upon. And when they go to a new ship, that would then change, and they would get new insignia, the unit specific insignia.
Yeah. So looks like the crew complement for an Imperial I class Star Destroyer is about 46,000 to 47,000 personnel. So that's stormtroopers, officers, other personnel aboard. I don't know. That's an average complement. I don't know what the Chimera or any of the other Star Destroyers above Lothal had at the time, but that's a good rule of thumb. That's a lot of people.
That's a heck of a lot of people. That's like football stadium size crew.
Yeah. Now, I will say it's probably fair to estimate that a chunk of those soldiers are deployed down. You've got a garrison, obviously, on Lothal that has to be staffed. So I don't think that the full complement of the Star Destroyer is always aboard. But still, I mean, even if you cut 10,000 out of that, that's a lot of people.
Yeah, that's still a heck of a lot of people, which is important for what happens with this when Thrawn and his armada, or three ships, it's more of a task force, come back. They start firing on civilians. I mean, I know that's a war crime. Can you elaborate on that?
Bad Thrawn. The end. That's gonna be my next article on the site, is just Bad Thrawn. And that's all it's gonna say.
I mean, I was impressed with how Ezra, you know, tries laying the smack down on him, and his reply is, "Are you done?" Here's what I'm gonna do: open fire. It's like, okay, that's way to get your point across, Big Blue. That's you're playing to win. Well done.
The legal point aside, it's not a very subtle move or a calculated move by Thrawn. This is a pretty heavy-handed approach. And in World War II, you saw a lot of the same thing. You saw a lot of bombardment of civilian areas, whether it was Tokyo, the Germans doing it to London in the Blitz, the bombing of Dresden or Berlin, all these places. And it really exacted just a huge, unfathomable toll of civilian life. And so, in the wake of World War II, and in fact, while all of these places were still smoldering and being rebuilt, the drafters or the folks behind the Geneva Conventions really took a look at that and sought to limit or eliminate that business of mass civilian casualties. And so generally now during hostilities, there's no bombardment of undefended places that's allowed, and that's written broadly. So you could be talking about a city, you could be talking about an undefended, say, hospital or something like that. It doesn't necessarily have to be the capital city like we see here. And then there's also, under the Hague tradition, as they call it, there's no destruction of civilian property unless it's, and here's the key, it's got to be imperatively demanded by military necessity. What's Thrawn trying to achieve here? The submission of the rebels. Is this the only way, destroying the entire capital city, that Ezra and the rest of them are going to surrender? You can make arguments both ways. I'm not saying that it's an open and shut case, because Ezra is pretty stubborn. But I tend to think that a guy as calculating as Thrawn is could have found another way that didn't
Yeah.
involve that kind of wholesale destruction.
Well, then, when you start firebombing cities, whether it's Tokyo or V2s hitting London, you know, or when you're in total war, you know, in that concept of we're now targeting civilian targets as a means to end the war by breaking them, that doesn't always break the will of the opposition. In theory, it could fortify it. On the flip side, when you look at the use of ICBMs, because those are targeted at cities. Sure, there are bases that are targeted, but I mean, look at the San Francisco Bay Area. How many military targets do we have here? You know, even if it's not, we don't have bases anymore, you know, I'm pretty sure there's an ICBM aimed at San Jose. There's another ICBM aimed at San Francisco. And that would just make the rubble bounce. Like there's, I mean, that gets into the entire concept of, you know, the point of the nuclear triad, which is inherently terrifying if you actually study it, and should make anyone question the use of how many nuclear weapons do we actually need. And the idea of tactical nukes is horrifying, but that's a digression of Thrawn firing on civilians to break.
Well, and you know, there is a concept under the law where civilian protection is not unlimited. You can have situations in which civilians forfeit the protection that's afforded to them under the law. I wrote, I think it was my very first article for the Legal Geeks about the use of the Death Star, and I posited that Tarkin's argument for firing on Alderaan would be that there's an insurgency there. Alderaanians might not have taken up active arms against the Empire, but certainly they had aligned themselves with the rebellion. And when you take direct part in hostilities, you lose that cloak, you lose that shield of the civilian status. I don't think you can argue that here. Lothal had mostly been subjugated. Really, any kind of mass uprising had already been quelled. You see these images of the citizens just kind of walking around and looking up at the Star Destroyers and the other sort of military armada that's there. These are not folks that are running around conducting an insurgency. And in fact, you hear Governor Azadi, the fake traitor in the finale, who's talking about how they need an army to fight the Imperials, and they don't have that. I think that goes directly to the point that there's no mass uprising. Thrawn can't rely on that argument to say that somehow Lothal citizens down below had forfeited their protections just because a rebel cell is running around loose.
Well, and it's also a great way to make them an army.
Yeah.
Recruiting for the rebels just skyrocketed. It was like, you guys did what? It's, you know, going from, you know, the walkers, you know, strolling through the city, forced to attend military parades, you know, and all the crap that, and using them as the Lothal people as slave labor to build advanced TIE fighters and other weaponry, that doesn't endear the Empire to the civilian population. And then firing on them, I'm like, that truly is the last straw.
The Imperials make this mistake again and again and again. If, for those of you who have read the Ahsoka book, the young adult Ahsoka book that came out about a year and a half ago or so, they make this mistake on this little backwater farming planet called Rada, I believe it is. And Ahsoka's out there leading a quiet life, and here comes the Empire to take all their resources and really put the populace under their boot heel. And by the end of it, they've sparked up a rebellion on the planet that's, you know, rapidly going out of control. And the same thing to a certain extent happens in the Lost Stars book. You know, anywhere the Imperials go and try to use this heavy-handed tactic, even if it doesn't involve, you know, an orbital bombardment like we see here, it really has a tendency to backfire on them, and they just don't learn that lesson.
Well, the entire Imperial doctrine for the Doctrine of Fear is inherently flawed. It doesn't break people. I mean, like, sure, it could. And again, if you blow up the planet where you're having a problem, that does ensure they won't be a problem anymore because they're dead. It does wonders for recruiting, to your side. It sows the seeds of your own destruction because people go like, you guys did what to who? You know, that doesn't necessarily make people capitulate and run up the white flag. It makes them dig and go, screw you. Let's start building. We'll build our own destroyers to take on you clowns. And
the U.S. has dealt with that exact problem since before the quote-unquote war on terror started. If any of you guys that have Hulu out there have watched the show The Looming Tower that's on there with Jeff Daniels. It's about the run up to 9/11. Obviously all this stuff is dramatized, but they're dealing with the possible attack on Taliban camps in Afghanistan following the bombing of the U.S. embassy in Kenya. This is like 97, 98. And there's this intense debate between the CIA and FBI leadership that's portrayed in the show. And they talk about this fundamental misunderstanding of the movement that at the time Osama bin Laden was the head of. But this notion that the CIA is saying, hey, if you stomp out the head, the body will die. FBI and some of its analysts are pushing back and saying, you don't understand. If you do these things, if you risk and are so cavalier with collateral damage, you play fast and loose with killing civilians, you're going to give them every recruit that they could ever imagine. And, look where we stand today. So these are all, I find it amazing and fascinating that Star Wars is willing to tackle these concepts in a kid's show, no less. Because this is stuff that the U.S. grapples with on a daily basis and has for a very long time.
Yeah, it's agreed. And like I was in college and law school when those events were unfolding. Mm-hmm. And I have strong opinions going back to we should not have abandoned Somalia. We lost 18 people, so we go, you know what? We lost 18, and despite the fact the Somalis lost 150,000, we're going to run up the white flag and abandon the area.
Adios.
Which only emboldened bin Laden and sentenced everybody living there to hell. So don't cut and run. On the flip side, fight smart. Using drones to blow up cafes to kill the wrong bad guy and 50 extra people who didn't need to die, not a good plan.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up too, because you see that could have happened here on Lothal, but for Ezra's success bringing those Purrgils in, I think a lot more of Lothal would have been destroyed. And so I wonder if they had ultimately succeeded and gotten rid of the blockade, you see at the end, the Empire doesn't come back to Lothal. Sabine is talking about in the epilogue that they kept waiting. She waited around on the planet for the eventual Imperial response, and nobody ever came. Well, imagine, you could have easily had a Somalia situation on Lothal where the Empire just crushes everybody and pieces out.
That too would have... It would have been interesting. I have great respect for Dave Filoni and the writing team that did this. And again, in a children's television show that people up until age 60 are watching and analyzing, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of Purrgils, we have the Lothal Wolves and the Purrgils used in combat. Mm-hmm. What can you educate us on the use of animals in combat? Because we do have some rules on that.
Yeah, generally, I think everybody understands that animals are used and have been used for a long time in combat, dating back to I think about the pigeons that were used in World War I. That's a very famous example. Dogs have been used in combat for, probably going back to the Roman times. So this is something that's long ingrained. And if you're talking about them as a weapon, there's a legal analysis, as dry as it may seem, that for any weapon, whether it has teeth and a heartbeat or just, as a machine gun or an artillery piece. And, the questions that are involved in the analysis are pretty much the same across the board. So part of it is, you can't use any kind of weapon that's designed to intentionally cause suffering. Now, I don't think you can say nobody designed a Purrgil, right? So just like nobody designed a dog or anything like that. The twist on that rule is that you can't use, even if the weapon's not designed for to inflict unnecessary suffering. You can't use it in a way that's calculated to cause unnecessary suffering. So I'll give you an example. I've got a pistol, right? A pistol is a lawful weapon, right? You can't say that it was designed to cause unnecessary suffering. But if I load it up with glass bullets that are designed to fragment and just really cause awful wounds and make it really tough to treat the patient because you can't see glass fragments under an x-ray, that's using it in a way that's calculated to cause unnecessary suffering. Or if I shoot you in the leg with the intent for you to be in a lot of pain or something like that, and really just struggle, that would be using it in a way that's calculated to cause suffering. Here, the pergils aren't really being used in that way. You know, they're, I think maybe unlike the wolves, this is a good example. You get a good juxtaposition here. By all accounts, the pergils come in from light speed and just sort of ram into the Star Destroyers. I don't think we see any of it, but presumably they're not out there smashing, you know, life pods and escape boats that are launching from the Star Destroyers. That might be a different question, but by and large, these are just big battering rams that float around in space and can also go to hyperspace. So generally, I don't think there's much of any issue with the pergils, although I find it awesome that they tied that back in, because that was one of the first episodes that I remember being very bizarre, very cool, but very bizarre when they're out on that fuel run and they run into these creatures. I think that was that season two early on? Something like that.
Yeah, I remember the episode, don't remember when it aired, but I did love the fact that they brought them back as a nice, you know, the circle's complete, because Ezra being the Dr. Doolittle of Jedi and having a, you know, connection with all cats and wolves and pergil, that, you know, his force power is interesting, because like, we don't see any of the other Jedi really do that.
Jedi Dr. Doolittle.
He is. And same with the wolves, that you know, they also seem to have like a higher level of sentience than that we would expect from other animals, because of, you know, the communication factor. While they're not speaking English, there is a connection, at least with Ezra, and the pergil are responding to a radio transmission. That's
Channel Zero.
Yeah. Now, was that Wedge Antilles who's on Lothal that did that, or is that character from the academy that Ezra was with?
The one with the kind of shaggy hair?
Yeah.
That's Martin Matten. Actually, okay. It's just I forget what. So he's named after one of the. His name is a jumbled version of one of the story group members. But he appeared in an episode. He's actually the nephew of Commander Sato.
Okay.
He had his own little Corellian YT-2400 freighter, and they were. What the Sato's Hammer, I think it is what it was called. I might have that wrong, but they had their little Iron Squadron or whatever it was called, and were fighting the Empire and had to get bailed out by the Ghost Crew.
Okay, that I remember that episode, because I was just like, who? It's because nobody calls him by his name in the episode, so I was at a loss for who is he. So that's good to know. Very good to know. I enjoyed seeing the pergil a lot. Great, great use of them. It does raise an interesting issue of, okay, so they take out the blockade. They take out at least one of the Star Destroyers, maybe two. Drag Thrawn off in Ezra to light speed to God knows where. With the windows broken on the bridge, so what kind of decompression issue was there when light speed?
Don't worry about that little guy.
I hope they're okay. They supposedly both survive. Do they get dropped off at a planet? It's Ezra now and what, 40,000 stormtroopers that he has to deal with? How does he make his escape? What happens? I mean, like they did a very nice setup for what can come next.
Oh, yeah. Well, before all that happened, there was a little nugget before they jumped to light speed. Thrawn is struggling and coming to the realization that something has happened. Somehow Ezra has pulled a rabbit out of his hat. And his blockade is up above, but he can't raise them on comms. And so there's this one line where he says, you know, get me Commander Pelion. And for those of you that really were in love with, you know, the EU and whatnot, I think you probably did a backflip when you heard Admiral Pelion's name get mentioned. There's no backstory on him right now, but Pelion, the character, is now canon once again. And Filoni said that he wanted to just drop that in there and leave the character set up for somebody to come in and take. So, you know, yet another instance where Filoni and the rest of the crew are really making sure to take care of some of those beloved EU properties.
Which is awesome. They did such a nice job in this series with those callbacks and the attention to detail. That was really cool. And it's nice having fans writing these stories.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And being the caretakers for what George Lucas and Lawrence Kasdan and everybody else created.
Yeah.
Because it was a team. It wasn't just one person. It was a team. And that people love. And the show was made with love.
I want to ask you, there's a huge part that we hadn't really touched on from the first of the three parts, which was we see the Jedi Temple being worked on and exploited and whatnot. It was something that we've never seen before. So, you know, the Emperor did his purge and whatnot, but we've never seen sort of what happened to some of the Jedi properties, with the exception of some of the comic books where you see like Gracchus the Hutt has a huge Jedi collection of just memorabilia, and the Emperor in the Lando comic very clearly collects some of the same artifacts. But what'd you think of that?
Great way to explore the mysticism of the Force, which is always, I always like seeing. You know, bringing it back to, you know, it is magic. It's faith. I thought that was neat. Seeing a religious temple being exploited was legally challenging because it raises all kinds of funky issues. With destroying Jeddah in Rogue One, like religious artifacts, you know, like aren't supposed to be targeted. You know, there are issues with that. You know, it's like, you know, could something be designated a historic site, which arguably a Jedi temple could be. And so to purposely desecrate it is problematic. Like we protect Native American lands now. You know, like we have those sorts of protections for other historic sites within the country. So to see them go, we're just going to desecrate this part of it, and because the Emperor wants a plaything, and you know, explains how he was able to access, you know, where Ezra and Ahsoka were in the space between. Mm-hmm. You know, that now makes sense, but yeah, lots of problems with it.
Yeah, real life, I will tell you that protected places, whether they be cultural sites like the Jedi Temple or, you know, hospitals are another big category, they're taken very seriously. I think if any of you guys out there remember 2 years ago or so, there was a huge dust up in the news over a hospital, an international hospital that was attacked by an AC-130. This is like a C-130 prop driven cargo plane, but it's modified and has just a whole bunch of weaponry out one side and can just level or deliver devastating amounts of firepower. So an AC-130 gets called in because allegedly there are Taliban members using this hospital, which would ordinarily under certain circumstances, make it forfeit its protected status, and the hospital gets leveled. Lots of civilians die in the process. Come to find out, the claims about their or the allegations that there were Taliban folks using it as a base or firing out of it were questionable at best, if not totally unproven. And that was a huge deal. I mean, that really, really, at the time, damaged U.S.-Afghan relations and really put things in a strained position. And I will tell you, you know, I've been in Afghanistan. I've practiced operational law and advised on these very things. And I could tell you, during mission planning, offensive operations are planned, special attention is given to these cultural properties. We would have extensive lists, and we're not talking just, you know, the major mosques or major facilities. We're talking down to some very seemingly minute things like a graveyard, right? You know, something as simple as that. It could be 10 graves in it, but it's important to the local culture, the local populace, and we're damn well going to be careful targeting it and avoid doing so unless it's absolutely necessary. And so that brings up an interesting question with the Jedi Temple, because no Jedi are actively using it, but the Jedi technically are enemies to the Galactic Empire, at least as far as Emperor Palpatine is concerned. So I think it's an open question whether he was justified to exploit it in the way that he was.
Yeah, you know, because I never trust anyone called emperor. Consent comes from the, you know, those who are, you know, governed. So that's problematic. We know he's a super evil dude. So again, problematic. Doctrine of fear. These aren't the good guys we're dealing with. They're the
bad. I will make it legal.
Yes. No. You know, when your game plan is, we're just going to get rid of the elected officials, appoint military governors, and blow up planets to make sure people knuckle under. Yeah, they're not the good guys. So,
from a certain point of view.
No, I think that's objectively bad. Just objectively not okay that you can't go, you know, might makes right. You know, we learned that from Once and Future King. No, it doesn't. Right makes right. I mean, I appreciate him appearing as, you know, the kindly grandfather, you know, Palpatine.
That was really bizarre.
Yeah, because he already knows you're the bad guy. So why are you trying to come across as the I'll wear white with, you know, gold and try looking like the kindly grandfather figure? Interesting use of force and holograms. So
that was terrifying when the whole temple starts to collapse and that visage just drops and flickers out and he goes back to his normal look. I mean,
it's just like, first, you don't have a dentist? I mean, seriously? It's not a healthy look, dude. I'm worried about you.
He's too busy ruling the galaxy to have any time to brush his teeth. And all of that was Mace Windu's fault to begin with. So that lawsuit is still pending. And by God, Mace Windu, his estate, will pay for all that dental work.
Yeah, you know, the Jedi really needed a Robert Mueller to, you know, do an investigation as opposed to let's just go throw him out of office ourselves.
Do you remember in that, because that image, you say Robert Mueller, and I just think toward the end of the Clone Wars, well, he was in a couple of the episodes. There was this little Republic inspector, this very short man, kind of with a receding hairline, called Inspector Tan Devo.
D-I-V-O. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Look him up on Wikipedia if you don't know what I'm talking about. And if you've seen the Clone Wars, you'll instantly be like, oh yeah, him. Tan Devo needs to be the Robert Mueller of the Star Wars world. And yeah. I think we can start a movement here tonight.
It's the right
special
call.
Prosecutor. We're digging deep tonight.
As we should. It's like, oh, yes, yes, yes. Again, I love this series. You know, I loved Clone Wars as well. And they really did a nice job of tying it up and leaving, you know, options. You know, I was in the camp that Rey probably was the offspring of Ezra and Sabine, and I still think that's a possibility since I think Kylo Ren was lying, but that's
Hey, it's not ruled out.
it's not ruled out because Sith say hurtful things. You know, that's how they get people to convert to the dark side, is hurting feelings and making people make bad life choices.
Yeah.
And so saying like your parents were drunkards who sold you for booze money, you know, like that's kind of a low blow. I can make somebody question their value system.
How did you feel about the epilogue?
I really liked it. The I'm like we're just pure fanboying here. Hera and Kanan had a kid. Cool. It made me wonder how long was she pregnant? You know, is it 9 months for her species or like 24? I'm like, what how did that work out for her? And is that why we don't? I mean, she's obviously, well, somebody's flying the ghost in Rogue One.
I was tweeting about this earlier, and I was just sitting back because my wife is pregnant and is due in May, and so naturally many of my thoughts gravitate toward space babies, right? And I thought, you know, was Hera pregnant at the time she's flying around and whooping tail above Scarif in Rogue One? Because that would be even cooler. And then you flash forward to Return of the Jedi. Presumably Jason has been born by then. And you think, like, is she handing him off to AP5? Like, here, you take care of him. Mommy's got to take care of business and save the galaxy once again.
It's, you know, working moms have it tough. I think AP5 would be a great babysitter, and that would be quite fitting. I love the epilogue confirming that Rex was on Endor. You know, like that was, you know, probably the biggest high five moment of the night of like, yes.
Which makes me, I don't want to get into it and dive down this rabbit hole because it's a topic fit for probably some other podcast. But a while back, there was some concept art, basically the mock-ups that they do in animation, and it appeared to be a mock-up of Rex in the Endor Pathfinder gear. All the soldiers that you see with Han Solo, he was mocked up in that. And I think they laid it side by side with an image of some of the rebel soldiers beside the bunker, and there's that one like white-haired dude in the middle of it. And you know, naturally the implication that was dropped there was, hey, that's Rex. And then there was a big dust up over whether that was whitewashing. And and right after the kind of controversy stirred up over it, I can't remember who it was that had tweeted it, but they were associated with the show. They backed way off it very quickly. And I guess looking back on it now, like now that we know the epilogue, you know, I was a little disappointed that you know, I don't know that I think that him backing off had more to do with not wanting to spoil the finale, and I'm glad they didn't. But at the same time, you know, I kind of wish that they had had some sort of conversation there about it. But anyhow, it's a little weird to see how close we came to a major spoiler.
Agreed. I mean, they teased it. It was nice fan service, in my opinion. And it was like, okay, that's nice. That was a nice little, just a nice hat tip. He was at Endor. It was like, well played. On the flip side, if he had been there, did he ever talk to Luke? You're a Skywalker too. I knew.
You look like somebody I know.
What's your name? Huh.
Sky what?
We should talk.
General Solo, General Solo, wait, I need to have a moment of your time, please.
Funny, I knew your dad. So, oh, you're gonna go? Oh, that's your plan? Tell him hi for me. So.
That's where the danger comes in making these connections. And I'm a fan of weaving these threads to a certain point, but you got to be careful because then you know, I'm not a big fan of lobbing out plot hole after plot hole or whatever, but you, when you connect everything in the galaxy, it starts to feel less big. The wonder of it starts to diminish a little bit. And I love that the idea of him fighting on Endor, but none of us need that. We've gotten so much Rex, like, let him go to the clone retirement home and, you know, play Parcheesi into the night. You know, go to bed watching reruns of Price is Right.
I liked it, and especially in light of the death scene with Gregor, as how they discussed, you know, fighting in a war that they chose to fight in, you know, that it made sense that he would be there to the final battle. So I take it as a good way to conclude the character story, and wherever he then went off to enjoy retirement for whatever amount of time that he had left. Like, I'm okay with that. Now, I also do want to point out the galaxy is big, that we don't, you know, in A New Hope, Mon Mothma and, you know, Hera aren't on Yavin for the fight. So they either had to, they probably either started a partial evacuation. You know, you don't have all your leadership in the same place. You know, they're not on Hoth, and like, and that's a good thing. So you can have rebels scattered across the galaxy. And yeah, they came together for the big final battle, but you know, they could be off in other places because there's a huge empire to fight. So again, I'm okay with that as well. Of It's nice to have some connections, but it doesn't have to be like a giant interconnected, you know, story, which is why I was also okay with the idea of that Rey's parents were nobody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yet another podcast for another day.
Exactly. I'm okay with that. Or yeah, not everything has to be connected, but I appreciated the end with Ahsoka and Sabine going off to go find out where Ezra's been hanging out for 4 to 5 years.
That's the series that I want. Either that or an Adventures of, because you pointed out to me shortly after the episode, you said, well, wouldn't Poe have been about the same age as Jason, maybe with a little bit of separation? And then my mind immediately went to a, you know, a show about the adventures of young Poe Dameron and Jason Syndulla. And if we don't get a Sabine and Ahsoka show or a comic or something, that would be amazing. A little Poe and Jason team up.
That would be cool, and that would work for me because they're close in age. I believe Poe was living on Yavin, and because that's where his mom plants the Force tree that she and Luke rescue. So I don't remember how old he was in that though, but he, you know, he existed. So yeah, they could be close in age. That would be neat.
Best buds.
Poe might be a couple years older, would be my guess. Just a couple, but I don't know how many. But yeah, that would be fun to have them as wingmen growing up, having adventures, because both would be pilots. I just don't want the situation where Poe got Jason killed, but that's another podcast, another
It was as
podcast.
if a million voices cried out and were suddenly silenced.
Because that kid would be force sensitive. I mean, high likelihood would be force sensitive.
How many midichlorians does he, what's his midichlorian count? I need
Yeah, well, we don't need that. We just need to know that mom was a really good pilot, dad was a Jedi, and you know, it's unless the Jedi's being a recessive gene, like, you know, he's a good chance of being force sensitive. And that would be neat. Also, you know, did Thrawn help build the First Order? Or was he, or do we have something else that happens? I mean, I haven't read all the books, so I don't know if they filled in all the gaps from the end of the Empire, but you know, could he have come back with the, you know, Imperial remnant, and you know, we have some of the EU story kind of come back in. I'd be okay with that. Or if Or if Thrawn's in the next Star Wars movie, I'd be okay with that as well. See a
maybe
live
that's
act?
Yeah. I think you're about to say what I was going to say, which is a live action show next year. Maybe we're getting a Thrawn live action show.
Which, when we talk about that, so I don't know if they've announced any animated series coming out in the future. We do have the Jon Favreau live action that will be on demand, and I trust him. I have no idea what time period they're going to be in, what part of the galaxy they'll be in. Cool. Very excited. We have the trilogy from the Game of Thrones guys, and I've only seen one episode of Game of Thrones. It's not my thing.
Shame. Shame.
No others who say
I'm making a reference that you're not going to get.
No, I'm familiar with it. Yeah, but it's just, I looked at that. I was like, that's a lot to binge. I can't do that.
So, right there.
I'm sorry I missed this. So we got that. We have the Rian Johnson trilogy. And are they moving away from standalone movies? I don't know if they're opting to do kind of an alternating trilogy instead of standalones. I don't know if that's their plan now.
I will say this might be sacrilegious amongst Star Wars fans, but I am not a fan. I'm not a fan of the every year model. I think what we've seen over the last, two going on 3 years is, as much as I love the constant stream of content, I think more broadly it's getting close to a Star Wars fatigue. And I hate to say that, because I will never get tired of this, constant drip of stuff. But I think more broadly, you keep cranking out these movies every year, and it's unless they sort of switch it up a little bit with how they're doing things. It's not like the MCU where, hey, this year I've got a Captain America movie, next year totally switch gears and it's a Spider-Man movie or Iron Man. It's just that the property doesn't really lend itself to that. And I don't think, even if you're focusing on individual characters or a different time period, Star Wars is lumped together in a way that the superhero movies just aren't.
So I do have my concerns about this as well. I like the idea of this being embedded with the holiday season, that mm-hmm. you get a Star Wars movie annually. Like that, I'm comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be like the MCU, because we can't have three Star Wars movies a year. The story doesn't work that way. It needs to be a special, and I like the idea of it. Right now, being annual works for me, but I don't want mm-hmm. Star Wars fatigue to kick in. I think the show on the Disney streaming service, that could work for me, mm-hmm. especially if there's like what we're going to have between the Solo movie to Episode 9 with a long break in between. That could be enough of a palate cleanse. And that's okay. If it's every 12 to 18 months for a Star Wars movie, I'm okay with that. Because that's enough for me for it to be special, that there's one time of year that way everyone gets excited for a Star Wars movie, much like people get excited for, say, the Super Bowl or the World Series. It's a reason that we can come together and go geek out together. But if it suddenly turns into like more than one a year, I'm really scared.
Yeah.
I remember the drought, from 83 to 99, and then there's the prequel period, and people feel disillusioned and all those feelings that happened. Then we had the Clone Wars, which was kept the dream alive. Books are coming out in that period, and then 2015. I'm like, that's a long gap in between those movies. So I don't want to ever see a gap like that again. I don't want to go like, hey, I'm going to be in my 60s the next time I see a Star Wars movie. It's like, I'm not happy with that plan either. but they really, I just hope they pace themselves. That's my wish as a fan. I am totally on board with going opening night to you know, on an annual basis. I like Christmas or Memorial Day weekend works for me. I get it. But I don't want it to lose the magic. And if they make it MCU-ish with more than one a year, I think that's really dangerous. But I trust Kathleen Kennedy. She's made good decisions. Disney won't make mistakes. They're going to work really hard not to screw anything up for all the money that they put into this thing.
Right.
And, you know, I just believe in being happy. It's something to look forward to. I try to avoid fan theories. You know, people get sucked in and invested in a weird way, and that can destroy the joy. It's like, just go and enjoy it.
And think of all the sad people out there that had invested so much time and effort into really believing that Snoke was Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah.
Think how crushed they are right now, even a few months after Last Jedi. I assume those wounds are all being reopened as it's released on, you know, DVD and Blu-ray.
It's, you know, I wouldn't mind a curveball that, you know, Kylo Ren's cape is made out of Ewok. You know, stuff like that. That it's like, well, he really is evil. It's like, I'm sure it's a warm cape, but that's just mean.
I flew to Endor just to collect the skins necessary for this.
I mean, if he went to go get his grandfather's, you know, head, of course he
played. And also this frumpled helmet.
That he probably, he could have made a cape out of.
I multitasked thanks to the dark side.
Snapping Ewok necks and with the force. It's like,
ugh. He's got the crumpled up helmet under one hand and just dragging Ewok.
Ewok belts on the other.
He's gone real dark here.
And I think it's hysterical. They would never do that. Ever. They just kill rooms full of children as dark as they go.
Unless Eli Roth starts making Star Wars movies, I think you're right.
I mean, like, we can be concerned about the Game of Thrones guys, so...
That's true.
They could throw a curveball that nobody's expecting. But, no, I just... Give me one a year. It's been a wonderful family tradition that we've had with it at Christmas time, and I enjoy that. It's made Christmas shopping for myself and my brothers super easy. You know, I look forward to being able to take my nephews when they're old enough. So for me, it's like, I'm comfortable with it, but everyone should be rightly concerned that we don't want to oversaturate.
Yeah.
Now, do you have, I mean, since we just talked about the dangers of this, if you were a showrunner for a live action Star Wars, what would you want to see?
As a showrunner, I think I would be pulled in two directions. I would want right now to blaze some new territory, because I think with Solo coming out in May, you have really crowded up the space in and around the original trilogy. And my mind goes to two places. I don't think that you're going to see a time period post episode 9 until episode 9 comes out. So I think that era, whatever it's going to be, is off limits for the time being. It's probably on a whiteboard somewhere at Lucasfilm right now.
Uh-huh.
So it leaves you with either the 25-year period between the Aftermath trilogy that Chuck Wendig wrote and Bloodline, which is the Claudia Gray book that happens just a year-ish, 2 years before The Force Awakens. You got a lot of room to play with and a big galaxy as the sandbox that you're going to play in. Or, and there's some, you know, plenty of stuff that you could do in there. Or you go all the way back and we're looking at something pre-prequels, either an you know, Old Republic or Reshape, and I don't know what they would and wouldn't honor as far as you know, the architecture of the story that goes there. But if I'm a showrunner, you know, my interest is obviously in doing something that's going to have some mass appeal and be successful. So you know, I'd avoid the original trilogy, but I would probably try to put something in that 25-year period. The pre-prequel stuff you'd have to be a little careful with, I think. You know, you could do a kind of a cool series about the Jedi or something in the early days, but yeah, I don't know. You're going to be blazing a little new territory there for, you know, the casual Star Wars fan. I don't know if the would pick up and watch something like that. But I don't know, if you add in like dragons and fire breathing and giant wolves, hey, Game of Thrones has proven that anything's possible to be popular, so
Yeah,
who knows?
my hope is just be different. I mean, you know, there are the things that work well in Star Wars with hero's journey and the Force, but we saw with Rogue One that you can have completely new characters that reference the Force, and nobody's a Jedi. Like you can do something that, again, unique. You know, the in-between period that we have is, I think, a good place to fill in gaps or just go in a radically different direction of another part of the galaxy.
A remake of Ewok's Caravan of Courage. That
The Ewok
truly
Adventure.
the truly magnificent 1980s show.
We're not. We need a. They had two specials. We don't need a third, or a standalone movie with Ewoks. I'm happy without those things happening. Just something different, you know. Go to the unknown territories. Go to wild space. You know, just pick. You know what works. You know, Star Wars is really good at hope and friendship and loyalty. Go
I tell
there.
you what, this just occurred to me. You know what? I've been talking all about these time periods and stuff. You know what I would write if Captain Thomas Harper were the showrunner of Star Wars? I would write a Star Wars legal drama and give every Star Wars attorney, Star Wars fan who also is an attorney or an aspiring attorney or somebody that's just interested in the law, what we really want, which is, you know, a show. Hey, you got Ahsoka's court martial in there. You get a little Law and Order. You're some Jedi prosecutors or something like that. Who knows? You could shake it up quite a bit, and really create something good there. A little Star Wars Law and Order, maybe.
Well, that does sound like a dream. I'd be okay if people understand. We could just have an episode with a couple lawyers in it. Doesn't have to be the full series, just an episode or two.
Governor Tarkin, I don't think we should do that. Too late. There goes Alderaan.
Oh,
Womp, womp,
the paperwork.
womp.
Yeah, there's. It's a tough one. I just. Be unique, pick a different era. You know, I do like, on some levels, the Imperial era does work well. I mean, you can fill in the gap pre-Rebels, post-Revenge of the Sith, you know, for the young Empire. Again, post-Empire, you could do, even though the First Order technically are Neo-Imperials. You know, you could be dealing with, you know, the post post Imperials who are still fighting, and I don't know how much of that would cross over to any of the book territory.
You do like Cheers, but it's at the cantina. And Woo or the bartender is just an asshole to everybody.
Well, and that's the other thing with the TV series, with like how much space travel do you have? And sure, shows like Star Trek and Doctor Who, the answer is you can do a lot. But you go the DS9 route and have it be on a particular planet at a particular place. And Favreau's working on His next movie, The Lion King live action, up until
Yeah.
release, that's 2019. So this could be 2019 to 2020, maybe 2021. I don't know. I mean, just look at how long Star Trek Discovery was in production.
That's a good point.
Yeah, there's. If they, I think they're going to time it so we don't get oversaturated and we always have something to look forward to. That's my wish. And I will be there wearing a Star Wars t-shirt and a notepad in hand to take notes so I can blog about it later.
Yeah, and let's be honest. We talk about what we'd prefer or whatever. All of us will be sitting there cross-legged in front of the TV, staring up at it, watching with glee, no matter what it is.
Well, that and here's something that's profound. I would want nothing to do with the making of it because I want to go and enjoy it.
Yeah.
I prefer being surprised. Like, I don't want spoilers. And if you make it, you kind of lose that. Because and I think, was it Gareth Edwards or Rian Johnson who talked about that experience, that like when you're making it, it's a different ball game. Because,
Totally.
it's not like you get to go and party and watch it. I mean, you go do the victory lap. But, yeah.
Right.
So with that, a lot of fun to discuss the law. And for those who are listening, we will be at WonderCon for the first time on March 23rd. And at 5 o'clock, we have our Star Wars mock trial. Judge Stacey Beckerman is presiding over it. It's in room 207. There was a typo initially. They fixed it. And it's can R2-D2 and C-3PO sue the Cantina for discrimination? Thomas, you are representing the Cantina with our good friend Steve Chu.
And we will win.
We'll justice will be done. So there's interesting issues there. And representing the droids are Christine Peake from McManus Faulkner and Megan Hitchcock, who I went to law school with, and she's a trial attorney for Esurance. So it should be, and everyone from the judge to the lawyers arguing are such hardcore fans, it's not funny. So, I mean, like, I know Judge Beckerman has Star Wars dresses. Megan has serious Star Wars art up at her house, in addition to Star Wars skateboard decks to go on the wall. Christine is similar in her geekdom and love of the droids. So, both Stephen and Thomas, you both have epic toy collections. So this should be.
We're gonna bond.
Yeah, the right lawyers are doing this. It's the only way to describe this. It's a place for all the nerd lawyers to come together who love Star Wars, and Carrie Bean from NASA JPL will be a expert witness on droids. So it's going to be, if you're going to be at
I look forward to
WonderCon,
cross-examining her.
she is so awesome. Yeah, I mean, the fact we'll have R2-D2 and C-3PO there
That's
is
phenomenal.
I'm so happy. I'm gonna go hug people. Yeah, we'll be sure to get pictures. It's gonna be fun. It's gonna be lots of fun. So yeah, we'll get to play for the weekend at WonderCon, and maybe we'll record something. So with that, Thomas, thank you so much. And how can people follow you on Twitter?
So you can find me on Twitter at Thomas L. L as in Larry, so it's just capitalized Harper, HARPER, at Thomas L. Harper.
Outstanding. So with that, America, stay geeky, America.